Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Elise Matatal, and last week I had the pleasure of speaking with Crystal Mittelstadt, the executive director of the Chinook Fund and the former director of Survivors Organizing for Liberation, also called SOUL. SOUL's now closed, but was an organization that was focused on providing resources and support to LGBTQ survivors of all different types of violence. Take a listen to my conversation with Crystal. Well, thank you so much for meeting with me. I really appreciate you taking the time. Before we dive in, do you want to introduce yourself, your name, pronouns, and some of the hats that you wear in the community?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. My name is Crystal Mittelstadt. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm the executive director of Chinook Fund. I joined the organization in 2018 as staff, but I've lived in Denver about 18 years now, so have long history in the community. And I wear a few different hats. Currently, I'm a member of the Colorado Solidarity Fund, which is a local investment club that helps support cooperatives in the state of Colorado. And I'm also an advisory board member of the Wealth Reclamation Academy of Practitioners, or WRAP, which is a national kind of think tank and doer organization that's doing work to really shift our thinking around resource mobilization and how we fund movements. Previously, I served as co-chair of the Resource Generation, a national organization that organizes young people with access to wealth and class privilege, and have also been involved with Transformative Leadership for Change, a local BIPOC-led leadership and capacity building group, as well as the National Giving Project Network.
Busy, busy.
Yeah.
So it seems like a lot of your work is around like wealth redistribution and looking at fundraising from a more social justice lens. Can you share a little bit about what Chinook Fund does, sort of the model that you all take? Because it seems pretty different than most nonprofit industrial complex type organizations.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually want to start my response with just sharing a little bit more of like how I got here, because I think that is part of the story of Chinook Fund and the kind of work that we do. So I grew up in a pretty small town in Oregon, come from like a working class family. My dad retired from a paper mill a couple of years ago that he worked at for more than 30 years. I also identify as queer and non-binary, mixed race, Japanese and white. And I was the first person in my family to get a college degree. So I started working in anti-violence work many years ago, and actually was a former Chinook Fund grantee at that time. And during that work doing programming around violence prevention, I started to realize that within the organization that the folks who had decision-making power and really could steer the direction of the work knew how the money worked. They controlled the fundraising, the grants, the budget. And so I decided to join the development committee, and that really shifted my thinking around how we resource our work and who gets to set what priorities, but also helped me begin to gain skills to learn how to move into some of those positions myself. So Chinook Fund, we are in our 36th year. We were founded in 1987. We are a community foundation. Our mission is to seed community-led systemic change by mobilizing resources for and trusting in grassroots social justice organizations across Colorado. So we've distributed about $4.5 million since our founding. Many of our grantees have budgets of just around $100,000, $150,000. So they're very small, oftentimes volunteer run or just startups. And we do focus on funding constituent-led work, community-wide work, and work that really has a lasting effect or a systems change component. And we prioritize funding community organizing as a primary strategy for change, in addition to focusing on rural organizations outside of the Front Range and Black-led and Indigenous-led organizations. And one of the things that brought me to this work, besides, you know, having a history as a grantee of Chinook Fund while I was doing queer and trans anti-violence organizing, is that we really lift up community leadership and expertise with a strong analysis around the intersections of race and class and other issues and how that affects our work. So really getting back to having community control of resources, but also giving folks from a variety of backgrounds opportunity to own this work and be a part of this work. So we are a fundraising and grant making organization. And one of the things that brought me back to the organization is the Giving Project, which is our model of grant making. So it's an innovative model for funding social change and fostering leadership. We launched the model in 2016, along with a national cohort of other social justice funds. And the Giving Project is a 6-month-long program. We bring together cohorts of, around, I would say, 16 to maybe 25 individuals. It's multiracial, cross-class, diverse in, what professional experience folks may have, where they're from geographically, what other identities or experiences they hold. And we give them the opportunity to have transformational conversations about race and class, to build their skills around grassroots fundraising and democratic grant making over the course of 6 months. So they actually go on to then contribute to the grant fund with their own donations, and then they go out and fundraise from their networks, having one-to-one, values-based conversations around the importance of supporting social change work versus charity work, which is oftentimes what we see, getting supported within the nonprofit sector.
Shout out to the Giving Project. As a recent alum, it was truly one of the most intersectional and diverse places that I've been able to participate in. In my cohort, there was someone who had just graduated from high school, all the way to folks who were older adults, and it was just truly one of the most intentional spaces that I've been in. And I really appreciated the way that the facilitators helped us think about the many dimensions of intersectionality. As we were looking at grantees, we were sort of pushed to think about like how are marginalized folks in this community being thought of? Are we looking at different sexual orientations and gender identities and disability status and all the different dimensions? And it was just really thoughtful and a cool place to be thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a unique opportunity to learn together, but also to take action together. And I think that that's so important, because we can focus so much on, we just need to learn more, educate people about these issues that are critical. And oftentimes we kind of stop at the education, or we stop ourselves when we're the ones, learning new things because we're too scared of making mistakes. Or we're scared of not knowing enough, and we let that hold us back. And I just really believe in the Giving Project model of equipping and supporting, groups of folks to take meaningful action together. And also to recognize, like, you're not going to get it perfect, and perfection is not attainable and also not the goal. So get out there and talk about the things that are on your heart, and, like, speak to your values and encourage people to be a part of this with you. And when you make mistakes, we're going to be there to support you and hold you, accountable with love, but also you still get to be a part of this effort. That making a mistake doesn't mean that you don't have a place or that you don't belong. And I think that experience can be really healing for some folks as well. Because our social justice spaces can be really difficult. We can really kind of tear each other apart in different ways. So yeah, it's been a really great transformation for our organization.
Yeah, I was thinking too. I saw that you might be an Adrienne Marie Brown nerd, and I did a
Yeah.
past episode about pleasure activism. That's been really helpful for me thinking about like how do we not sort of dispose of folks in our community, and maybe we could take some lessons from folks on the right who are just like letting people come in and welcoming and building hateful coalitions. Maybe we could bring coalition work into more social justice spaces, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to remember we all started somewhere. Like, I went through my annoying righteous phase, as a college student that was getting politicized around lots of different issues. And, I was really excited and passionate and learning about things. And I think about, who are those individuals now who, are new to this work because, for whatever reasons, maybe because of privileges or just access or lack of access they've had to different conversations or spaces that we want to welcome them. We want to be ready to scale up quickly. We never know when the next moment, whether it's a disaster, a political moment, other crisis, may mobilize people. Like we saw in the summer of 2020 with the uprisings for Black Lives, that, like, we should be building our organizations ready to, mobilize on a massive scale. So I think I really appreciate the groups that are looking forward like that. And Adrienne Marie Brown is definitely someone that continues to influence me, as well as many other folks that have been part of the LA Media Conference community, which is where I first got connected with her and many other, leaders doing really cutting-edge work.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. I'm your host, Elise Matatal, and I've been speaking with Crystal Middlestad from Chinook Fund about how we mobilize resources to fund social justice movements in equitable and intentional ways, and their work with Survivors Organizing for Liberation, which closed its doors a few years ago. Sort of shifting and going back to something you said around being able to mobilize sort of in times of crisis. I know that in your role as executive director and also in this space wider, you were sort of holding folks to account around the Club Q shooting fundraising efforts. Someone forwarded me an email that you sent that was sort of pointing out ways that the process for accessing funds can be re-traumatizing. And I could go through all the details, but if you wanted to share around like how you personally or how your community has been impacted or involved in sort of the Club Q fundraising efforts, since it's so tied closely to your work.
Yeah, there, you know, I would say for LGBTQ plus communities in particular, especially those at the intersections who also identify as BIPOC, transgender, you know, undocumented. There are so many different ways that trying to access governmental resources that usually are controlled by the state, which require police reports and just a high level of engagement with those systems, can really be re-traumatizing. And in my experience previously working for the Colorado Anti-Violence Program, which went on to become Survivors Organizing for Liberation, we saw that time and time again, whether it was within shelters, you know, requiring people to be housed with, you know, men, if their legal identification said male, even if they were a transgender woman, for example, or working with law enforcement. I worked a case in Colorado Springs where the DA wouldn't charge a domestic violence charge because it was a same gender couple. And essentially they had the power to just say, I don't believe this is domestic violence because I don't believe in, you know, queer relationships. So there are a lot of issues with access when engagement with those systems is involved. So, you know, I had the experience of witnessing that firsthand as an advocate and trainer doing work with SOL over several years. So we were oftentimes on the ground providing rapid response, working with the media, working with families, survivors and victims, as well as navigating systems, you know, so advocating within law enforcement, you know, for certain, you know, access or protection or charges that a survivor may be looking to seek out. So when this, you know, came to be, I was concerned about those systems and also just concerned about just the lack of conversation that was happening within some of the statements that were coming out and organizing that I was hearing about. And also I've been very aware of the, I guess I would say vacuum, for lack of a better word, of like, we haven't had another statewide anti-violence, you know, more politically radical group emerge since the closure of SOL and BSEEDS, which I think continues to be a huge loss. It continues to be something that, you know, I grieve myself. That's where I really found my chosen family and my political home is a young person moving to Denver many years ago. So I do still have hope. You know, there is some different organizing happening in different pockets or different spaces, but in terms of a group that is led by and for LGBTQ plus folks that's focusing on issues of violence and criminalization and abolition and, you know, mutual aid, we haven't really seen a coordinated effort around that. So some of the role that I played, you know, I was kind of like toggling two worlds, you know, in one way I was speaking with my Chinook Fund hat on as a funder. I have access to certain spaces and certain relationships. And then just as a person who I am in this world as a, you know, queer, mixed race, non-binary person, you know, who's in community as well with people that are directly impacted by these issues too, that I wanted to be able to kind of speak to both of those experiences. So I have been providing some support for some national funder organizing. Some of that work has been led primarily by funders for LGBTQ issues, which, and also including the Contigo Fund, which was emerged in the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando in 2016. And yeah, we've really just essentially been trying to work to help a group of national funders who fund LGBTQ issues or communities to understand what's happening on the ground in Colorado Springs, kind of who to support, what are the barriers that folks are facing. So there is some organizing happening around creating a pooled fund that will then distribute that money to the local Colorado Springs community. And so I was able to help make a couple introductions to some of the funders that that I had relationships with. But what I will say too is just the infrastructure is really lacking in Colorado Springs and also in Colorado overall for LGBTQ organizing and support services. We really do need longer term investments in that community and in the rest of the state to support power building, support justice work, organizing, and just spaces for community for our folks. So, there are some different groups that are doing some of that work, but even things like finding mental health providers that were trans competent. I mean, I was just reaching out to people in my own personal network, trying to find out like who can provide services, even if it's virtual, so getting to the Springs isn't an issue. And it was challenging. I was able to find a couple of leads and helped with those referrals to get those to local folks on the ground. And then also helped connect with a couple of trainers, some local and national folks that could help with event security training, because that is a very active need that that local folks are and organizations are looking at as they consider beginning to get together in person again to hold public events or even just like internal organizational events for members and volunteers. So we really need that infrastructure. And I also just want to say that, crowdfunding for, the Club Q mass shooting, and the many different losses that we experience in our communities individually and collectively, it's never going to fill the gap that's been left by devastating cuts to our social safety net. So I just want to acknowledge there has been, a lot of controversy and like some very public attention call to some of the platforms and some of the funds and, crowd funds, as well as the Colorado Healing Fund, and as well as some mutual aid efforts being led by and for the impacted community. And we need those funds, whether they're mutual aid funds or crowd funds, to be managed by the communities that they exist to serve. And I think it's important to recognize that like structurally it's never going to be enough, and oftentimes it does create a lot of competition. It creates divisiveness. There's not always like, or there's oftentimes not transparency or accountability for how funds are distributed. So, those are real challenges. And I don't have like an easy answer to that. But I think in some more of an acute situation, sometimes donor organizing can be one of the avenues for that. So with donor organizing, thinking about how to work together with small groups of donors to pool their funds collectively to then directly move that money through, Venmo, Cash App, PayPal to survivors. So there have been some like very small kind of, more low-key efforts around, to be able to support people in those kinds of ways too. But it's a really, yeah, it's definitely a really big challenge and a big issue.
Yeah, I'm struck by sort of your unique position as someone who's done sort of crisis work. Also, this long-term view of thinking about our social movements as like an ecosystem that's interconnected, and just wondering how you balance that. And also, maybe I'll throw in like, sounds like you do a lot of like trauma work, and just curious how you take care of yourself and find joy. I think I kind of know, but I wanted to pose it to you.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, it is, there. I would say there are more of us who have come out of organizing who now work in philanthropy, which I think for me has really helped me understand the importance of the role that Chinook Fund plays. Even though our grants are small compared to many other foundations, they are meaningful in that we oftentimes will take a risk on a startup group, a group that doesn't have a documented track record, that may be considered too risky or, just too new to be funded by a more established foundation. We feel really, proud of and committed to our investment in building those relationships and taking a chance on folks, taking a chance on groups of people that come together to address an issue in their community. So I continue to see, the importance of that. And, we know that the wealth, the resources, the money is there. Like there is enough capital, there is enough, resources for everyone to have their basic needs met, because of our systems, including capitalism and including the sector of philanthropy, we continue to, allow the wealthy to set the terms, set the conditions for how those dollars are distributed or if they are distributed at all. So I really see, the Giving Project and the kind of like grant making that we do as an intervention, or like in the, in the field of philanthropy, it's not a solution. And it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't negate some of those other issues. So I feel, yeah, I think that, and it's also the resource mobilization, the grassroots fundraising, the development work is the behind the scenes work in many spaces too, and oftentimes is not appreciated or resourced, or people are just like, I'm so happy I don't have to worry about the money. I just want to be out there and do the programming. And I found for myself, being exposed to folks trained through GIFT's model of grassroots fundraising, the Grassroots Institute for Fundraising Training, that when we address it from a cross-class, multiracial space and use fundraising conversations as a way to educate a base, build a base, to organize a community, that it becomes one more tool in our toolbox. And I found that that was the lane that I was really passionate about and continue to be passionate about and skilled in, and want to bring more folks into that space because it is. It does tend to be predominantly white in terms of who's holding those positions within at least 501c3 organizations. And that also helped me get over my own internalized classism and racism as well. Like I am not someone who came from wealth. And so being able to recognize, like, I can identify as a donor, I can be thoughtful in my monthly giving, I can go out there and still organize donors who are giving, several thousand dollars a year to a cause that they believe in, and help them see what role they can play, what impact they can have, as well as working with our smaller gift donors as well, and recognizing that we need all of us to be able to resource this work. Yeah, and I think in terms of the how I take care of myself, I'll be really honest that the doing anti-violence organizing for, close to a decade, I was pretty burned out. So when I left Seoul and at the end of 2013, I moved to northern New Mexico to like the middle of nowhere, sold all my stuff. And I was like, I'm going to raise chickens. I'm going to learn how to be a beekeeper. I'm going to learn how to grow more food. And I left the city for just a little over a year, and really took a lot of time to think about my relationship to paid work, my relationship to organizing, my relationships to like the people that I, my neighbors who I live, who I live nearby. And I felt like a lot of my values were intellectual in the work, and I was always leading. We were all leading our introductions with all of our most oppressed identities, and not oftentimes talking about where we had power or where we should be held accountable. And I think doing anti-violence work too, I just had a lot of guards up. I needed to soften. I was always prepared for harassment or prepared for harm or mistreatment. And living in this small town in northern New Mexico was really, it was really challenging in a lot of ways, but also I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about what it means to be somewhere where the first question is, who is your family? Where are your people from? As opposed to, what identities do you hold, or what labels, are meaningful to you? And I think, it gave me some different perspective on some of that work. So having, I think for me, I realized one, I need to be in a city. Country life was just too extreme for me. And even though I grew up in a small town, it wasn't that small. I was in a town of like 200 or so people. So it was a pretty extreme example, but also like I needed something to really shift fundamentally. So moving back to Denver, I think some of the things that really help is one is just having like a really strong community. I'm really grateful to have the loving people that I have in my life, that we really show up for each other. We show up for the celebrations, when there's births of new children, when people are, partnered or getting married, people get new jobs, all those kinds of things, as well as being there when folks are going through medical issues or illnesses or losses in their families, and just making sure that, that there's care, we're checking in on each other, we're cooking meals, we're dropping in, and those sorts of things. So having my folks to lean on really helps sustain me, and then I like taking time to get into nature, taking time away from, my phone and just being online, or just even like reading or listening to books, just giving my brain space to just breathe and kind of like process the different, yeah, just the different things that might be happening in the world, can be really helpful in sustaining, yeah, sustaining myself in some of this work.
Yeah, rest can be really important and radical. especially in this space that feels like things are moving constantly. I wish we had so much more time. I have so many little wormholes that I want to go down, but just in the last couple of minutes, is there anything you want to share with listeners, whether it's like letting people know about the upcoming cohort for the Giving Project or anything you're excited about that you want to share?
Yeah, we are always recruiting for the Giving Project. So we're currently recruiting for our fall cohort that launches in September. And we have several informational sessions coming up that are virtual. So our next one is on May 16th from noon to 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time. And you can go to our website, chinookfund.org, to sign up for that and get more information about the program. And we're really just looking for folks that have a commitment to this work. You don't have to have previous training in grant making or fundraising or be a super skilled, you know, fluent social justice activist either. Though if you are those things, that's welcome as well, because your skills can really contribute to the success of the cohort. But definitely encourage folks to check that out. And then I also just want to lift up, you know, some of the groups that we fund or groups that that we work with that might be a good place to support for LGBTQ folks looking for community or looking for other levels of engagement. So in terms of Colorado Springs community, Inside Out Youth Services is an LGBTQ plus organization that provides a variety of programming. Voices Unidas for Justice is a BIPOC-led indigenous group that does a variety of victim services and prevention work that also allies with LGBTQ community. And then just speaking with some folks in my realm around, like, who do you refer people to now that there's not, you know, the hotline with Soul or the work of BSEEDS? And Joy is Resistance is a newer group that does provide some programming for young people. So encourage folks to check them out. Queer Asterix is a group of therapists, mental health providers as well. So if you're looking for therapeutic support. And then Fortaleza Familiar is one of our grantees doing work with Latinx and Indigenous queer young people in the Denver metro area, but also somewhat statewide. And there's also a newer group. We just funded a startup called Mountain Pride that's doing events and different work in mountain communities. So yeah, happy to shout out some of those organizations.
Woo. Thank you so much for doing that. Last episode, I interviewed two folks from Fortaleza Familiar, so that's awesome. You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. I'm Elise Matatol, and you just heard my conversation with Crystal Middlestad, Executive Director of Chinook Fund. For more information about Chinook Fund and some of the great groups that Crystal lifted up tonight, you can visit news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Join us next week, Monday, at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of Outsources, providing you homegrown queer radio every week. That's Monday, 6:30 p.m. right here on KGNU, or listen anytime after the broadcast at kgnu.org/outsources.